Oh, 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 O'Reilly!
Are your wiper blades chattering, skipping, or squeaking? Don't let streaks or smearing on your windshield compromise your visibility. When it's time to replace your wiper blades, stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts and see our selection. Our professional parts people will even install your new wiper blades while you wait. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm sure a lot of you guys remember the old ceremonial hunting tradition of eating the heart out of the first animal you kill. Meat from those organs are among the most nutrient-rich foods on the planet. You can get those same benefits your ancestors craved via convenient daily capsules from Heart and Soil. Find out more at heartandsoil.co. And remember, use code MEATEATER for 10% off your purchase.
Welcome to the Wired to Hunt podcast, your home for deer hunting news, stories, and strategies. And now, your host, Mark Kenyon.
Welcome to the Wired to Hunt podcast. I'm your host, Mark Kenyon, and this is episode number 362. And today on the show, I'm joined by the legendary DIY Michigan bow hunter, John Eberhardt, to discuss what exactly he would do in some of the deer hunting world's toughest scenarios. All right, welcome to the Wired to Hunt podcast, brought to you by Onyx. Today on the show, we've got John Eberhardt back with me. And if you're a longtime listener, you're familiar with John. He's been on here quite a few times, I think three or four, somewhere in that ballpark over the years. But if you're not familiar with John, here's a really quick intro. He's one of the most successful DIY bow hunters that I know of, especially in the state of Michigan. He's got dozens of record book bucks. He's written multiple books, which I highly recommend, such as Precision Bow Hunting and Bow Hunting Whitetails the Eberhardt Way. He's done all of this on public land or by permission land, and he's doing it in tough locations, and he consistently has success, and he's great at telling people and teaching people how to do something similar. So, like I said, I've had John on the show over the years. You've heard kind of the basics of what he does. Some of the, you know, what do you do with rubs? What do you do with trail cameras? What do you do in this, blah, blah, blah. But I thought, what's a different kind of way that we could approach a hunter like John? How might be there some different ways we could learn from him? As I'm stewing on this, I started thinking through different scenarios and thinking, you know, what would John do in that scenario? What would John do in this scenario? And let's say you're all set up in a tree and another hunter comes waltzing by and you've got an hour and a half left of daylight. What would John Eberhardt do in that scenario? What would John do if he was dropped into a brand new property at the end of the summer and he only had one day to figure it out and prepare for the season? What would he do in that scenario? Those kinds of questions started popping in my mind, and they were the impetus for this episode. What would John Eberhardt do? I think that there's something we can learn from a hunter, not just by asking him or her, what do you think about X? But instead, put them in a scenario and ask them to explain their thought process, what exactly they would do, why exactly they would do it, how exactly they would do it. I think that we can learn something new when you approach a topic in that kind of way. And that's kind of my hypothesis for today's episode. I'm thinking, I'm hoping, I'm pretty damn sure that we can get a new level of insight from John by picking his brain on a bunch of example situations. So that's what we did. I'm grilling John, one of our community's very best deer hunters, on a bunch of hypothetical situations, very specific, and we're going to hear how he would approach it. And I got to tell you, spoiler alert, there are going to be a lot of cool things that we cover. I'm very much looking forward to it. So I think rather than me rambling about it, rather than me talking about how great this episode's going to be, we should just get into it and see if it can actually live up to that billing. I think it will. Every time I've ever talked to John, I've learned something, and I trust this will be the case too, hopefully for you as well. So let's get right into it. All right. I am very excited to have back on the show with me, John Eberhardt. John, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Oh, well, thanks for inviting me. My pleasure.
It's always a treat for me because as you know, as I've told you, probably every year we talk, you were one of the most influential people in the early stages of my serious deer hunting journey. And I've grown a lot because of everything I learned from you. So it's just great whenever I can get you back on the show, because I know other people will benefit from it too. I've got a cool idea. I think it's a cool idea. Maybe you'll think otherwise, but I think I've got a cool idea for this chat. But before we get into the real meat and potatoes, I just got to hear real quick off the bat. It's been a weird spring, a weird summer with everything going on with COVID and everything else. I'm just curious, regardless of that, how do you feel about your deer hunting prospects this year? Is everything looking okay? Were you able to do the scouting you needed? Is everything still on track?
My shoulder surgery hampered my season last year. This year, yeah, I got out and did all my scouting. All my scouting's done. Everything looked great. Did some additional public land scouting, reprepped all my old locations. Everything's cool. I'm shooting 50 pounds. I'm shooting about 6 arrows at a time. My shoulders, I'm still having issues, but I'll definitely be able to hunt. But as you well know, I don't go out and look for deer. So I just hunt according to the sign that I see during postseason from the previous year's rut. So I don't go out. I have no idea what's on the properties I hunt, because I don't own anything. I don't lease anything. Everything's pretty far away from where I actually live. So.
Right. Now, is that something that, do you ever, I can see an inherent benefit to that, because there's always a certain sense of surprise when you go out there. You don't quite know what's running around. And when you see a buck that you want to shoot, it's a holy smokes. Look at this deer. I had no idea he was out here. That's really cool. But do you ever find yourself occasionally hearing about somebody else who does get to specifically target one buck over the course of weeks or months or years? Does that appeal to you at all? Or is it, you're really happy with what you got?
There are times when somebody that actually hunts the same properties as me tells me there's a big buck there, or they show me a motion picture, because I never hunt a property by myself. It's public or free knock on door for permission. So if I have somebody show me a picture, yeah, that definitely raises my level and makes me concentrate more on that piece of property. And that's what Miles Keller used to do. Miles Keller is an old school guy, but, he always targeted a single buck. He'd drive around through the countryside with his job, and he'd see big bucks, and then he'd get permission. This is back in the 70s and 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And he would target those individual bucks. And, yeah, that always makes it a different type of a challenge. But when you're hunting like I do, where you're trying to go to a lot of different places, you just don't have the time to put out cameras and take inventories. It's too far away. When I go out of state, I hunt cameras exclusively. We put cameras at every single location, and we hunt according to what we see on the cameras. But there's always big bucks there. The last two seasons in Michigan, I haven't even seen a Pope and Young buck at all. Wow. There's times when I go to Kansas, I'll see 15 Pope and Young bucks in a week. So, it's definitely different here, as you well know.
Yeah.
And I've had pretty good success on not doing a lot of preseason scouting and turning bucks nocturnal before season even opens. I've shot a few bucks, bucks early in the season. So I'm kind of doing what I do, and I like doing it. But once in a blue moon, I will know there's a big buck on a specific property, and I will actually target that buck and try to kill it.
So that was what I was going to ask next. Yeah. So I was curious. That's exactly what I was going to ask next. I was trying to rack my brain to think back through all the past stories I've heard from you, trying to think about if there ever was a year where a certain buck got under your skin and just changed all your plans and you had to focus on him. It sounds like that has happened before.
Yeah. It happened in 2014. There was a big buck on a little 2-acre parcel that I hunt, and somebody told me about him. I had never seen him. So I went in there, during September, during a hard rain, and being 2 acres, I used to hunt it. I used to hunt this property, and somebody seen this buck cross the road after dark. So I went and got permission to hunt it again, and the lady had never let anybody else hunt there. Nobody else had asked, because it's such a small parcel. And there was a cattail marsh that butted up to her property, and right at the back of her little 2 acres, there was a little transition zone into that cattail marsh. So I went in there, and I, on the edge of the cattails, there was a bunch of red brush, and I went in there like on September 20th, and, you know, 3 weeks after the bucks are all rubbed out, the bigger bucks, and it was all trashed up, you know, just rubs all over the place down that edge. So I prepped a tree because it was rainy, and I wasn't going to make a lot of noise, you know, it masked my noise. And I prepped a tree, and that buck was kind of under my skin, and I shot him opening morning at 8:15. And wow. It was 154-inch 10-point.
Yeah, that's a heck of a buck for a two-acre property, especially.
Yeah, it just, there's very few years, you know, in where I hunt, in public and stuff that I hunt, where things work out perfectly, and that was definitely one of them.
Yeah. So that kind of fits really well, that story fits very well into my idea for our chat, because I think this is our fourth or fifth one of these we've done together. And over all those years, I've kind of grilled you on a bunch of different tactics. I've asked you, you know, what do you think about trail cameras? What do you think about scrapes? What do you think about this, that, and that? So we've got that kind of high level understanding of what you do and how you do it pretty well. So I started to think, you know, what would be a way to get it a new, like the next level of nuance from you. And my idea was this, John. I thought that I could just pitch out a variety of different scenarios to you. I'll outline a scenario, and then what I'd like to hear from you is, what would you do in that situation? I think we could learn from all these different examples. So I'll put something out there, and then I'd be really curious to hear, what would you do? How would you do it? Why would you do it? Maybe there's a story from the past where this actually happened to you and you can tell us that. But I've got some interesting situations lined up that I'm really interested to hear how you would tackle. So if you're game, I want to start playing What Would John Eberhardt Do?
I'm always game. It might take me a few seconds to sit and think about something to process it, but
that's perfect.
Know, on a short-term thought process, we'll see what we have.
I love it. I think that'll be great. So let's do that, John. And let's start with something that's a little bit like what you just described. It's a scenario that some people might find themselves here in the coming weeks. Let's say it is late August, and out of the blue, maybe the mailman stopped by your house and you got into a conversation with him, and he happens to find out you're a deer hunter. And, you know, he's been your mailman for 20 years. And he says, you know what, John, you can hunt my property. I've got, you know, 40 acres or whatever just back here. Go ahead, hunt it. But it's the last week of August, and all you have is 1 week of available time that you could go see it, scout it, prep it. You've got like a day and a half, 2 days max. Can you walk me through how would you use that day and a half of weekend time to absolutely get the most you could out of this brand new property you picked up on the last weekend of August?
Yeah, because that's happened to me quite a few times, actually. What I would probably do is I would grill the guy. You know, if he owned 40 acres, that's a pretty, you know, that's a, for Michigan, that's an average parcel. I would ask him if he knows of any decent bucks on the property that he has possibly seen, because if he was a mailman, that means he's probably leaving his house pretty early and coming in the evening, coming home. And I would ask him, I'd obviously look at an aerial, and I'd ask him what the layout of his property is, aside from looking at an aerial, just to see what borders his property. I'd ask him, okay, on your bordering properties, you know, how much hunting pressure is on the bordering properties? Is there a swamp on your property? Is there a swamp that butts up to your property, you know, where a deer may be coming out of a swamp in the evening, you know, right at the edge of darkness because it butts right up to his fence line? I'd basically not grill because the guy's given me permission, yeah. But I'd ask him a lot of questions, and it's very possible once I looked at an aerial photo of it, you know, if it was just open timber or 20 acres of open timber with no understory and there wasn't any bedding area on it, if it was, you know, 10 acres of pasture, if there wasn't any oak trees on it, because he would know if he owned it, if there was oaks on it or some apple trees. I would ask him what the actual property looked like, what it contained. If it did have oaks, would they butt up to some semblance of security cover for a daytime visit? Or if they're just oaks out in open timber where a mature buck in Michigan's not going to access that place during daylight hours because it's too vulnerable with no understory for security cover. And then I would go from there. If it was something that I didn't think was conducive or better than what I already have prepped, you know, because I'll have 40 trees prepped going into the fall. I may only hunt 10 of them or 12, but I've got trees ready. So if it's not something that I think is going to be overpowering as far as this is something where I think I can go in here and kill something on a pretty short-term time frame because it's got a bedding area or it's got some apple trees button up the security cover or it's got, you know, oaks that butt up the security cover, you know, it would totally depend on the layout of the property. I may just put it off and totally not even go there and, you know, scout it during postseason the next spring.
Okay.
But if it had everything I needed, I'd wait for a hard rainy day or I'd wait for a very windy day because a 40-acre parcel is really, really small. As far as if it had bedding area on it, you know, it's going to be a relatively small bedding area. So I'd wait for a nasty day where it's going to mask the majority of my noise and the majority of my scent, even though I would be going in scent lock. I'd go in on a nasty day and I would very cautiously look the property over if I thought the property was going to be conducive to have a mature buck on it that might move on that property during daylight hours. And I would also take, because it's only 40 acres, I would take my prep gear. And if there was something that I saw that looked conducive for daytime movements, I'd prep it right there on the spot so I didn't have to make a second trip.
So when you say you'd walk it very carefully, can you elaborate on exactly what you mean by that? Would you just go and check out the few spots that on the map look the best, or are you going to cover the whole thing or just the edges? Like, how literally are you going to check it?
I'm going to check primarily the edges. If there were a bedding area on it, I would definitely not intrude into the bedding area in late August. There's no way. I would definitely look at the edges of the bedding area to see if there was any mast or fruit trees. And the cool thing about going in there in late August, I would know not only if there were mast or fruit trees, I would also know if they were bearing food, you know, because I could see the acorns or apples in the tree if it had that. So I would just go the edges of any, you know, projected bedding areas, and I would just walk gingerly and slowly because I wouldn't want to spook anything. Because a lot of times, you know, when you go in and you pre-season scout, which I don't do anymore unless it's in a situation like this, which is very rare, but when you go in and you pre-season scout, a lot of times the bucks are not bedded back deep into the bedding areas. They're on the perimeter edges of them. So you got to be really, really cautious, you know, and move slow, you know, and you just got to be as quiet as you possibly can because you don't want to intrude on anything. I did a live webinar the other day, and a guy had a situation very similar to that. He actually pulled in on this piece of property, and he saw a buck that had been bedded in a fence row, and it was moving across a little opening in a pasture towards some timber. So he didn't go over there, but he asked me how I would go about setting up on that. And I said, well, what I would do is obviously that buck is probably bedded in that fence row because the fence row, he said, had a lot of heavy security cover. It was probably bedded on the edge where he could see out into the little open pasture. And he probably had the wind coming in from his back where he could smell anything coming in from the other side of the open area. So I said, what I would do is I would go around through the timber, you know, way outside of the open pasture, and I would go back around to where that buck was heading. I would do it on a rainy or a windy day, come back in the timber from the opposite side, and I'd go and try and find out why, you know, for a buck to get up and move, there's a reason he was going in that direction.
Yeah.
And, you know, this time of year, it was food-based. It was probably food-based. So there was probably something over there, some form of a food source, you know, maybe an early apple tree. It's way too early for dropping acorns. But I'd find out why the deer was going that place and if he could find that location, set up a tree, and then go back out the same way. Because if he were to go across that open pasture and that buck were still bedded in the same place he was when he saw him come out of there, probably that buck is going to visually see him going across that opening. So he wants to definitely go around where there's not going to be a visual, and it's a nasty day. It's not, if he preps a tree, the buck's not going to hear him, and then he's going to go back out the same way he came in. And then on opening evening, he could go back in the same way, way around, and go to that spot, and hopefully that buck gets up and keeps that same pattern, and he might have an opportunity at it.
Interesting. So here's another scenario then that's a little bit related to what you just described there. As you mentioned, that buck was probably heading where he was because of a food-related attractant of some kind. I want to kind of understand better how you choose between potential early season spots, you know, opening night sit kind of situation. So let's assume it's October 1st, and of all the different places you have prepped, of all the different properties you have, let's say you're down to two different stand sites that seem ideal for early season. We're going to say that, you know, all the conditions seem lined up for these spots, but one of them is overlooking, let's say, a couple apple trees, and the other one is set up it's next to a big lone white oak tree. Both of them are dropping. They're both kind of ideal. Can you walk me through how you would try to pick between those two? Maybe you've got a clear-cut favorite between those two food sources, or maybe you could describe what other factors you would try to look at to determine which is your top option of those two good options.
That one's really, really, really simple because I always do. Let's say I've got 40 trees. I think this year I've actually got like 45 trees prepped. Probably 20 of those trees are going to be potential first day or two or three of season trees. They're going to be early season feeding locations or potentially a primary scrape area on the edge of a standing cornfield. So what I always do, and I've done this for years, I will put on scent lock and I'll try and wait for a windy day, but it's not that critical. And I do what I call a speed tour.
Yep.
Now, because Michigan season opens on October 1st, I usually wait until at least September 20th before I do a speed tour. And what a speed tour consists of, I haven't been to any of these locations since at least April, so I haven't been there all summer. A speed tour consists of visiting all of my existing potential early season locations at mast and fruit trees or scrape areas and seeing if they're actually bearing food or if the scrapes are active. And a scrape along the edge of a crop field, I won't hunt it unless it's in standing corn. I don't care how active it is. It's got to be standing corn with security cover. So once I do that, you know, if there's multiple, let's say there's 10 locations that are dropping mast or fruit. And let's say there's one location that's the scrape area standing and it's next to a standing corn field. When I do this, the reason I do this on September 20th is because the bucks have been rubbed out for at least 2 weeks, if not three. Most big bucks up north are rubbed out easily by September 5th. So there will be, according to how much doe traffic is visiting these feeding locations, there will be buck sign around these locations. So I will hunt them according to the amount of rub sign, how high the rubs are on the trees. You know, if it's at an apple tree, it's not uncommon at all by September 20th to have scrapes underneath it. It's even not uncommon to have scrapes underneath a white oak tree if there's not a lot of white oaks in the area, if it's isolated. And keep in mind, all of my early season locations, everything is security cover oriented. So I don't ever prep any locations unless there's some form of perimeter security cover around what I term the kill zone at a destination spot, like a master fruit tree or a scrape area. Mm-hmm. And I also won't set up if there's not excellent transition security cover to that kill location from a known bedding area. Because a mature buck in a pressured state like you and I live in, they're not going to get out of a bedding area and walk through 200 yards of open timber with no understory security cover to access a feeding location, even if the feeding location has security cover around its perimeter. So it has to fulfill the security cover requirements for me to even set it up in the first place. And then I base which ones I'm going to hunt according to the amount of buck sign that was at the location and the type of buck sign at the location when I do my speed tours. And it, I'll do about three speed tours to hit all the public land and private parcels. And I only have two private parcels I hunt, but it'll usually take 3 days to do my speed tours. Okay. And they're all after September 20th. Now, did that answer the question?
It answered it perfectly. I've got one additional question, and I feel like I might have asked you this question several years ago. I can't remember if I asked you this slight version of it. And here's what I'm curious about. I know that you don't look at wind direction when choosing stand sites because of your scent control. You're not worried about deer smelling you. But do you ever take into account how deer might want to use the wind? I can't remember if I asked you that or not. Do you ever think about, well, this buck might want to approach an apple tree with the wind somewhat in his favor, so this stand would give that deer an advantage versus that stand? Does that ever enter your mind?
Yes, it does. And your dad asked me that. but that's okay. I get asked that a lot, and it's a very, very viable question. And yes, the answer is I do set up certain locations, especially scrape areas. If I go in and I find a scrape area and it's in a terrain feature dump where it might be where a oak ridge drops down into a cattail marsh or there's some cattails on this side and there's briars over here and there's a nice edge line and there's a river here where a deer will skirt the river, you know, basically where several terrain features dump together. If there's a scrape area there and there is a tree on the south or southeast side of the scrape area, and it's 15 to 20 yards from the scrapes themselves, that's more than likely the tree I will set up, because it's extremely common, and I've shot two monster bucks in Michigan this way. And again, I'm not worried about getting winded. That never, ever enters my mind. But it's really, really common for a mature buck to come in, especially in the middle of the day. They do this a lot midday during pre-rut and rut phases, to come in and skirt around the actual scrape area or come in from the downwind side, maybe to 20, 30, 40 yards, and they will just scent check the scrapes without actually going into the scrape area because the scrape area is open. So scrape areas are always in an open area. It's always a small opening someplace. So in 2004, for instance, I shot 100, and believe it or not, it was 154 inches. This is the exact same size as the one I shot in 2014. It was 154 inch 10 point. And he did exactly that. I was hunting between two bedding areas, and there was a pinch point, and there was a scrape area right there because it confined doe traffic. And when there's confined doe traffic and there's a lot of doe traffic, that's where bucks make scrapes. All buck activity during the rut phases revolves around doe traffic. So that's where they lay their dominance markers. So I'm up in this tree in my saddle, and it was election day, 2004. And I voted in the morning and I drove down, and this was in southern Michigan, is over by Grand Rapids actually. And I drove down and I got my tree, I don't know, I think it was around 1 o'clock, which is kind of late. And about 2:30, here comes this buck out of this bedding area. And he was actually coming from upwind of upwind of the scrapes. He was coming in from the north. The wind was out of the north. So he was actually going with the wind. But when I seen him coming, and the foliage is down, so I can see a little bit of a distance, as he was coming in, I thought he was going to come into the scrapes because he was making a beeline right at the scrapes. When he got about 50 yards from the scrapes, he started going east, and he went around the scrapes to the east, and I had a lane that direction. I had a shooting lane that direction, so I swung 180 degrees around the tree to the opposite side, and by the time I got around there, his butt was just going through my shooting lane. So I swung back around to my original position, and now he's coming in and he's making a circle and he's coming around behind me. Well, he got behind me, so now he is 100% directly downwind of the scrapes and directly downwind of me. And he was at about 40 yards, and he stopped and he sniffed, and a smaller buck had came in and urinated in the scrapes about an hour earlier. So he smelled that and he turned and he walked right up, and he stopped right under my tree, and my tree is about 15 yards from the scrapes. but he walked directly to my tree, so I can't take that shot. I won't take that direct straight on shot or straight down shot. So I'm sitting there, and I mean, if I would have spit, it would have went on him. He was directly under the tree, and then he just raised his nose and did a little lip curl and, you know, did a little like that, and he turned back around. You know, there hadn't been a doe there, so he turned back around and went in the exact same footsteps he came in from, and he started to turn back around, and now he's going back north. He's going back around. He's going through that east shooting lane that I had. So I swung back around the tree, and this time I'm ready, and when he got in the shooting lane, I just did a vocal doe blat and stopped him, and I was a full draw and I shot him. So, wow. You know, that was a situation where I set that tree up basically because I know big bucks like to scent check certain areas from downwind.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have found when I'm hunting at apple trees, bucks will typically, the wind is irrelevant. If they're coming in to eat apples, they're usually going to come in from wherever the thickest cover is. And I've been preaching this for a long time. So if there's excellent security cover on the back side of an apple tree from the tree I'm hunting from, I'll rape the front of that tree so I can shoot to the back side. Because usually they'll come in and they'll stay in the security cover, stick their neck out a little bit, eat a couple apples, turn around, go back through the security cover. They won't come out into the open underneath the tree like the other does and sportsman bucks will. They'll stay tight to that security cover. So in that situation, it's not so much a wind situation as much as a security cover oriented situation where they want to be in the security cover where they got a quick exit.
Okay, that makes sense.
Now, a lot of you guys are familiar with the old hunting tradition of eating, you know, some organ, the heart or a chunk of liver off the first animal you kill. I had that when I was a little kid, and it was a big deal. Organ meats were always prized by frontier people who knew the importance of getting a lot of different minerals and nutrients. And as often is the case, those guys were onto something because organs are among the most nutrient-rich foods on the planet. And you can get the same benefits your ancestors craved via convenient daily capsules from Heart and Soil made exclusively from regeneratively raised grass-fed and finished cattle. Heart and Soil's unique freeze-drying process means all those important nutrients are trapped in, ensuring you experience every one of the benefits of nature's superfood in a clean, convenient, taste-free capsule. Find out more at heartandsoil.co. And make sure to use code MEATEATER for 10% off your purchase. That's heartandsoil.co. Use the code MEATEATER. O'Reilly Auto Parts are in the business of keeping your car on the road. O'Reilly Auto Parts offer friendly, helpful service and the parts knowledge you need for all your maintenance and repairs. If you're confused about what part you need, like what wipers are going to be the best, what replacement headlights are going to be the best, go into O'Reilly and talk to the people that work there because they're great and they're super friendly and they'll get you squared away where you walk out knowing you got the right thing. They've got thousands of parts and accessories in stock, either in-store or online, so you never have to worry if you're in a jam. Do you need your windshield wipers replaced? You need a brake light fixed? You need some quick service? They'll help you find the right part or point you to the nearest local repair shop for help. The professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts are your one-stop shop for all things auto do-it-yourself, and you can find what you need in-store or online. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today or visit us at O'ReillyAuto.com/MeatEater. That's O'ReillyAuto.com/MeatEater.
Okay, let's throw another scenario that's similar to this, or it's kind of a next step from what we've been describing. We're in this early season situation. You picked your top food source, and based off your speed tour, you're set up, it's a great night, conditions look great, you're excited about it, and let's say maybe 2 hours, give or take, before dark, another hunter comes in, right? You've got all the properties you share with other people. Another hunter comes walking through, he's got his wind blowing into really great cover. You know he's not practicing scent control as well as you are, so he stinks, he's being careless, and he kind of walks right through your good stuff, and he goes out of sight, but you know he made a serious ruckus and probably did some damage. In that scenario, do you stick it out, or do you call it and say, all right, the hunt's screwed, I'm out of here, I'm going to cut my losses, or maybe even try to go to a new location you know of. What would you do in that scenario?
If it's early enough, it's pretty rare that I hunt any location, whether it be public, private, or whatever, where I don't have multiple trees prepped. So if it's early enough and it's an afternoon hunt, yeah, I would get down and move. If it's late enough where there's no way I can move in time, I'm going to sit there and stick it out, even though I know my odds of killing anything are pretty close to zero. But I've had that situation happen a lot. I've also had it happen a lot where I'm in my tree way before daylight on public land. You know, I'm in my tree an hour and a half before daylight. You know, I'm really excited about the spot. And then, you know, I see guys pull up on the road because the foliage is down and it's a 3/4 of a mile away. I can see the headlights. And then all of a sudden I see these dudes with these bright ass headlamps that are 600 lumens.
And a little part of soul dies.
Yeah, and I have deer run by me, you know, a half hour before daylight as these guys are coming in, and I know my hunt's screwed for the day. But there was one time, and this was in 1997, and this was on an all-day sit. I had a guy walk right under my tree. I actually said something to him because this was on a 20-acre parcel, and I knew there was two other guys that hunted it, and I knew this guy wasn't one of them. And I actually quietly, when he was right underneath me, and he just had a red plaid shirt on and a pair of blue jeans and a compound bow. I said, hey, you know, and he looked up and he didn't see me at first because I was up so high. And finally I got his attention and I said, hey, I don't think you're supposed to be here. I know the guys, they have permission. And he said, yeah, you're right. I'm lost. I came in from the other property, which was bullshit.
Right.
So, excuse my French. But anyway, he left and he walked. He walked out on one of my shooting lanes, and it was actually the shooting lane that I expected if I did get an opportunity to get a shot at. That's the lane I thought the deer would cross on. And the guy had leather boots. So I looked at him as he was walking away. And I knew if a deer came into that lane, because the wind was blowing from the bedding area away, you know, across that lane. So I knew if a deer was coming out of that bedding area and he came into that lane, I'd have to take the shot before it cut those leather boot tracks that guy had just walked out on. Cause I knew without a doubt that would bust that deer if it was a big mature deer, which was what I was after. And it's straight up 12 o'clock. I mean, it was to the minute, 12 o'clock noon. And this big 14 point came down through the bedding area, sunny day, absolutely gorgeous bluebird day. And this guy went through at about 10:30, and I shot that buck, and I drew my bow just as his nose was coming into that lane. And I make my lanes relatively wide. You know, a lot of times I see people with shooting lanes and I'm like, how in the hell did they ever get a shot here? How did they stop a deer in that narrow of a shooting lane? But anyway, I stopped that deer just probably 2 feet before, you know, he would have sniffed that guy's leather boot odor, and I shot him, and that was a 150-inch 14 point. It was a typical 14.
Jeez. Would you do anything differently if, now I don't know what date you said that was, but back to the original scenario.
That was actually, I think, November 1st in 1997.
Okay, so maybe that answers my question for me, because I was going to say, if I change the date from October 1st to November, would you be more apt to stick it out, even if you had a bunch of time in the day, just because, you know, it's the rut and, you know, anything can happen? There could be a buck from 3 miles away that comes through.
I did that day. Yeah. I thought about moving because I was planning on sitting all day, and he went through at 10:30, but it was such a good spot and it was pre-rut, between two bedding areas, and I love to hunt bedding areas or transition zones between two bedding areas, and that's what this was, a transition route between two bedding areas with lots of security cover.
Yeah.
So I thought about getting down, but it was such a good location, and he went dead center through the middle of that lane, and that lane, that shooting lane was probably 4 yards wide. So I figured if a buck came from either direction in that shooting lane, I could stop him and take a shot before he hit that guy's tracks.
Yeah. Now, okay, let's look at another possibility here. Let's look at a different kind of a negative variable. So that scenario is another hunter coming through. What if you're in a perfect spot? You're in one of your primetime locations. It's late October or early November. You're in one of your honey holes that you've waited all year to go to, and a big mature buck steps out. He's about to step into a shooting lane, and then he spots you, or you make a noise and he catches, you know, looks up at your silhouette, or something happens and he knows that the jig is up, there's a person here, and he bolts out of there. What do you do in that scenario? Do you give up that day? Do you give up out in that spot for days? Do you give up on it for a week? Or would you come back there at some point because it's so good and other deer might be in the area? What's your thought process in that scenario?
I have to say, Mark, I've never had that happen in Michigan. you know, I don't have a saddle and I hide behind the trees, so I don't get picked, which is a major issue I'm having with a lot of this YouTube crap on saddle hunting, because these guys are hunting in small trees and sitting on spots where they can't move around and maneuver around the tree so they don't get picked. So I'm having major issues with that. And on my YouTube videos that I'm going to come out with, you're going to see why. But on that, I've never had that happen to me where I've gotten picked and a deer is busted. Now, when I was in Iowa, I had a buck come through, and it was 140-inch 8-point, and he stopped, and he picked me. He saw me in the tree, because I was in a tree. I couldn't move around to the backside because it had too much of a lean on it. And this was in 2001. But anyway, he stopped, and he looked at me for about 4 seconds, and it was just like on TV where they look at you and it's like whatever, and they put their head back down and kept going, and I shot him. So I shot him that time. But I guess if we're gonna just, you know, say, okay, you're sitting in a tree and a big buck bust you, odds of me hunting that location again would be pretty close to zero that year. And I think that would affect, even if that buck did make it through that year, I think that buck would remember that location and definitely look in that location for a person when he came into that spot. I think their memories are good enough to do that. I know does do.
That was my next thing I was going to say. What about with a doe? Would you, you get busted by a doe for one reason or another. Same scenario, but it's a doe this time. What's the plan then? Stick it out?
Oh yeah, I'd stick it out with a doe. And it would depend on where I was. If I were next to a swamp, or if I were in a bedding area, you know, during the rut phases, and a doe came in and she spooked and she did the typical snort.
She's blowing for 10 minutes.
Yeah, and left her interdigital gland odor and snorted and made all kind of noise. If I could get down and quietly go someplace else, I would definitely do that. To give you an example of a doe kill, and this happened, 30 years ago. I had a friend, and he was hunting in December on public land up by Everett. And he had a decent buck. And when I say a decent buck 30 years ago, it was like a 90-inch, 2.5-year-old 8-point, you know. But he was trying to kill it. And it was kind of on the edge of this swampy area, and there was snow on the ground, and he was baiting at the time. He had a pile of beets out. And I don't bait. But anyway, I was talking to him one day, and this was probably around mid-December, and he said, man, I've got this doe, and she comes out. She has two fawns with her, and she'll come out through the swamp and stop on the edge of that, right on the edge of the security cover, and she'll look at that bait pile, and she looks up at me, and he's in a big oak. He was in this huge white oak tree, and he was hunting out of a tree stand. I hunt out of a saddle. He was in this big white oak, and his stand was obviously against the tree facing the bait pile. So he had the whole big trunk of the tree as his background. But again, it's December, so all the foliage is down. And he said, two times in a row, that doe came out, stopped on that edge, looked in the tree, saw him, snorted, stomped, and, you know, for 30 seconds, and then turned around, ran back in, and he never saw another deer both evenings. And I said, well, do you want me to kill her? And he said, yeah, right. How are you going to kill her? And this guy was a good hunter. I mean, he killed a lot of stuff. Uh-huh. you know, a lot of little bucks.
Yeah.
And I said, well, I didn't ask. I'm not going to tell you how. I should just ask you if you want her dead. And he was kind of cocky like I was. And he said, yeah, if you think you can kill her, I'll go show you where it's at. So we showed him where it's at. And so that evening, I got up in the tree and the wind was right, because that's before I was using scentlock. So the wind was perfect for this evening. The wind was blowing from the swamp across the bay to the tree. And I got up about 8 feet above his tree stand, and I got on the 180 degrees on the backside of the tree. And this tree was totally big enough to block my silhouette. So it just like he said, almost to the minute, he said, here comes this big doe coming through the swamp. I could see her. She come right to that edge. Two fawns were behind her, and she stopped. And she looked at that tree up in the tree at the stand, and looked back down at the bait. She looked to the side. You know, it took her probably 3 or 4 minutes. And then she walked out to the bait. And there's probably a 3 day gap between the last time he hunted it and this hunt. Walked out to the bait. And when she was eating the beets, she was facing the tree. So she could see if somebody was in that stand, you know, she could see them out of her peripheral vision if there was any movement in that tree. Well, then the fawns came out, and you know how fawns are. They're turning all different sides. As long as mom's there, they're fine. So finally, after about 10 minutes, she slightly turned. So she felt comfortable, and she turned where she was quartering about 45 degrees towards the tree. And I just slightly leaned out to the side and took the shot and shot her. And that guy just freaked out. It was really cool.
That's pretty nice when you can show your buddy up like that, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, I wanted to prove it to myself because if I couldn't have done it, I'd have been kind of embarrassed.
Yeah. Oh, man. I got another one for you. We're gonna pivot a little bit. We're somewhere mid season, and you are heading in to hunt some public land. You've got a preset location that you had prepared at some point.
Oh, whoa, wait a minute. When you say mid season, what do you mean by mid season?
Okay, you're right. Good. Thank you for calling me out. I should be more specific.
I would not go in during mid-October to hunt public land in Michigan. It would be a waste of my time.
Yep. I should say mid-season, like late October, early November, give or take, somewhere in that pre-rut to rut time frame. Okay. And you've got a spot you're going towards that you feel good about. You're heading in, sneaking in. You've got a great access route. But along the way, you come across just some sign that you can't ignore. It's rubbed up like crazy. There's a bunch of fresh scrapes, insecurity cover, and there's an apple tree maybe that's been pounded by does. Just like all these things are stacking it up and it looks unbelievably good, but there's no quality trees in the area at all. Even if you happen to have your freelance kit with you to hang up in a tree, there's no tree. It's for whatever reason, it's just super shrubby stuff, and you're stuck with either going to your predetermined location or try to figure some other way to hunt this sign. Would you hunt that super fresh sign on the ground in some kind of impromptu way, or would you say, I got to stick with my plan, I'll come back and set a stand up here tomorrow or something?
I would stick to my plan.
Why
I would
is that?
Stick to my plan. If it was impromptu, because to make a sufficient ground blind requires some work. And if you have to break weeds or cut weeds or do anything cutting, you're leaving an odor. You know, I may be in scentlock, so I'm not leaving any odor. But if I'm doing a lot of cutting or breaking vegetation to make a makeshift ground blind, I'm leaving odor there that is not normal for that particular location on that particular, you know, at that particular time. There's just too much cleaning out or vegetation odor that could alter a mature buck's mindset as he's coming into what at that point would be a destination location for him. So I would definitely go on about my plan.
Now, what about, well, I guess I'm going to accept that answer, and I'm going to move on to this next scenario in which...
Go ahead. What were you going to say? What about?
Well, I was curious about if there was a tree there, would you...
Absolutely.
So
without question, if there was a tree there, I would absolutely, if the sign warrants it, I'd definitely set that tree up and hunt it right then.
But wouldn't, in that scenario, you would have been going to a preset location. So are you saying you would go back to your truck, get some kind of climbing ascension tool, and then walk back to that location, put in steps or whatever, and go up in the tree?
Well, typically when I'm hunting public land, I'm not hunting a preset location. It may be a preset location as far as, you know, I know where I'm going and there's adequate openings for shots, but, you know, I'm still toting my climbing gear with me. So if my climbing gear would fit on the tree that was accessible at this hot location, I would use my climbing gear on that location. As long as there was, you know, a lot of times when you're on public land, you'll see locations that are hot, but there's no trees where you have a shot opportunity because you obviously can't cut branches and clear shooting lanes to that specific spot. And the tree that you can set up does not give you a shot opportunity to that spot. So, you know, it would totally depend on the situation, but I would be carrying my prep gear with me anyway.
Okay. Now you get to your tree, you're hunting it, and This is a scenario that's happened to all of us, I think, and it's happened to me plenty over the years, and I've debated both internally and even externally on this podcast about what the right decision is to make in this scenario. And this scenario is you're sitting in a great location, you know you're in there for a reason. Deer should be passing through for several reasons that you've predetermined, but the big mature buck shows up and he's 80 yards, you know, away. He's off in the distance and you see him move somewhere out of sight. You now are stuck sitting and thinking, should I relocate to that spot for tomorrow? Should I stick it out where I'm in now? Because I think that it's more likely that another one will come through here for some reason because of all these other reasons that you originally set up there. I guess what I'm trying to say is how quick are you to move based off of a sighting and what factors have to be in place for you to say, yeah, I'm moving right away to that spot?
Well, as far as moving, obviously if I see a big buck and I'm set in a specific location, that buck has already moved through that location where I just saw him. So I'm obviously not going to get down and move there during that particular hunt.
Yeah.
But would I definitely move and go back there? I would definitely go back and look and see what the reason was that he was there the next day, possibly. And that situation is actually happened to me before. The biggest buck I've ever shot in my life was 180 incher, and it was in Iowa, and I was actually sitting and I had a decoy out and I was down in a swamp and I was going to be on an all day sit, and I saw a bunch of deer activity about 200 yards away, because again the foliage is down. This was in mid-November. The foliage was down. I saw deer activity, not necessarily buck activity, big buck activity, just deer activity a couple hundred yards away. So I got down at about 10 o'clock, packed up the decoy, put him in my military duffel bag and stored him where I, you know, so I'd get him on my exit after dark. And I just, you know, I'm in scent lock again. And I took all my climbing gear out when I descended the tree, just slowly walked back through there, found about back where I got to the area where I had seen that deer traffic earlier in the morning. Man, I just saw a scrape area from hell. I mean, there was four monster scrapes there. One of them had two huge clumps of deer droppings all clumped together, and they were big droppings. So I knew it was a big buck, and there was still urine in that particular scrape that I could see a spot of urine in it, which I don't know if the urine was his. The droppings were old, but the urine could have been something else. So I prepped a tree and I shot that that 180 incher that afternoon. It was a 12 point. And another time, and this one was in Michigan, I was sitting in a tree and I about 80 yards away, two evenings in a row. I actually hunted a tree two times in a row. And both times there was a decent buck. He wasn't a monster, but I saw a decent buck about 70, 80 yards away, going down the same, he went the same route both evenings in a row. So the next evening I went back in there and freelanced and I prepped a tree and I actually put out a doe decoy. And that evening that buck, because there wasn't any trees right where he was going through. So I took a decoy and I was set up about 40 yards from where he was going through on top of this little bridge kind of like. And he saw the decoy and he came right over and I shot him at 15 yards. And it wasn't a monster, but it was a good buck for the time. That was 30 years ago too.
Speaking of decoys, I know that historically you've been, you know, willing to do something like that or use calls or rattle when you're out of state, like Iowa or Ohio or Kansas or something. But in Michigan, from everything I can remember ever reading from you and hearing from you, you're usually very, very conservative with that stuff. Is a two-part question. Number one, has that changed at all? And number two, I want to paint one specific scenario to consider that with. Let's say you're hunting in a location and this big mature buck steps out in Michigan just out of range. Let's say, I don't know, 35, 40, 45 yards, whatever. Let's say 5 to 10 yards outside of whatever your comfortable shooting range is. Would you call to him in that scenario? Or is it still, like, where's that line for you in Michigan?
If he was that far away, 30, 40 yards, it would depend on what was between him and me. That's pretty close. if it's 30, 40 yards and there was really heavy security cover between him and me, I might possibly do a really quick, soft inhale grunt because I carry an inhale and an exhale grunt call with me. Or I might possibly do just a little light vocal, meh, you know, a doe mat. But if there were no, you know, if he's 40 yards away and there was nothing but, you know, a little bit of brush between me and him, and I do some sort of a vocal thing to try and move him closer, you know, if he's a big enough buck, he's going to take a look in that direction. And if there's nothing there visual, he's not stupid. He ain't going to come into it. It might happen out west, but not here.
Yeah.
So, you know, in that scenario, I don't know if I would do anything or not, but there has been several times in Michigan during the first few days of season, and I'll give you one really good scenario. This was in 1999, and this was on October 2nd, and this was a morning hunt, and I was up in a tree, and these deer were transitioning through some timber with some form. There was a little bit of understory in this timber, and they were probably 80 to 100 yards away. And all I could see was their legs below the canopy. I had no clue. They were heading to a bedding area that was probably 100 yards in front of them. I had no idea if it was does or bucks. So I took out my rattle bag, and I made a light sparring sequence, about 10 seconds, you know, with a little gap in between. And they both turned, and they started coming my direction. Well, when they got about 40 yards from me, they were facing my tree, and I could tell they were both bucks. It was an 8 and a 10 point. And they actually totally lost interest. It took them a couple minutes to get that far, and they had lost interest, and they started actually eating acorns under an oak tree. and I'm like, well, maybe they'll keep coming. And then they got lost interest in eating acorns, and they turned and started heading back towards that bedding area again. So now they're about 50 yards away. They're moving away from me again. So they're too close for me to do a sparring sequence again, because a sparring sequence takes time, and it's easier if they stopped. You know, they were within visual sight of me now because I can see them. At first, they couldn't see me when I rattled the first time, but they could visually see me in the tree. And obviously, if I'm going to do a sparring sequence that takes 5 seconds, you know, they're going to turn their head immediately, and they're going to see it's coming from up in a tree, and they're obviously not going to come in. So I took out my soft inhale grunt call and turned around the opposite side. You know, I was in my saddle and just made a really soft, light grunt, and they both turned and came right to the tree, and I shot the 10 point at 12 yards.
Wow.
So yeah, I rattle in Michigan. I've shot several bucks that make buck in of the 31. I've shot several that make buck in Michigan by rattling them in or grunting them in. That's not the norm though. I'd say maybe six or seven of them I've actually used calls, but most of them are, you know, I am hunting spots on the merits of the location, you know, their destination locations or their interiors, bedding areas. and I hunt them according to the merits that I chose them for. And I don't like to make any alterations. I want the deer to come in naturally. That's why I picked that location. So I will never do any type of a tactic on the first hunt at a location for that year. I want the location to work on the merits I chose it for. I don't want to booger it up by maybe when I decide to do a rattle sequence, because I'm going to do it like a half hour before dark, maybe that buck is transitioning to the spot and he doesn't like the way I did it, you know, and they got to be in the right frame of mind to respond to that stuff in Michigan. It's not like out west. So, you know, I'm not going to booger a destination location. I'm not going to booger it up with doing tactics on my first hunt. But if I hunt there maybe a couple times, let's say it's during the rut phases, and I hunt a really hot location and it's a primary scrape area or it's a feeding location where there's a lot of doe activity, and I hunt it and I don't see anything other than maybe a spike horn or four pointer and two does. You know, if the sign is that hot, there's an excellent chance that the buck that I'm after, if I know there's some mature buck sign there because the rubs are tall, that the buck I'm after is with a hot doe. You know, he could be doed up. So I'm going to hunt that maybe two or three hunts in a row. And maybe on the second evening, if I hunt it the next morning, then I hunt it the next evening, if I don't see anything half hour before dark, I may do a rattle sequence, you know, a sparring sequence or, you know, some doe bleeds or something to try and bring something in. But, you know, because a lot of times during the rut phases, a location will warrant you to hunt it several times in a row because the buck that actually left that sign may be with a hot doe during the time you're in that tree. But, it, you know, once her 28-hour, 32-hour cycle's over, he's going to start looking for the next doe, and then that time he may come to that spot, you know, in search of the next estrus doe.
Right.
Now, a lot of you guys are familiar with the old hunting tradition of eating, you know, some organ, the heart or a chunk of liver off the first animal you kill. I had that when I was a little kid, and it was a big deal. Organ meats were always prized by frontier people who knew the importance of getting a lot of different minerals and nutrients. And as often is the case, those guys were onto something, because organs are among the most nutrient-rich foods on the planet. And you can get the same benefits your ancestors craved via convenient daily capsules from Heart and Soil, made exclusively from regeneratively raised, grass-fed, and finished cattle. Heart and Soil's unique freeze-drying process means all those important nutrients are trapped in, ensuring you experience every one of the benefits of nature's superfood in a clean, convenient, taste-free capsule. Find out more at heartandsoil.co and make sure to use code MeatEater for 10% off your purchase. That's heartandsoil.co. Use the code MeatEater. O'Reilly Auto Parts are in the business of keeping your car on the road. O'Reilly Auto Parts offer friendly, helpful service and the parts knowledge you need for all your maintenance and repairs. If you're confused about what part you need, like what wipers are going to be the best, what replacement headlights are going to be the best, go into O'Reilly and talk to the people that work there, because they're great and they're super friendly, and they'll get you squared away where you walk out knowing you got the right thing. They've got thousands of parts and accessories in stock, either in-store or online, so you never have to worry if you're in a jam. Do you need your windshield wipers replaced? You need a brake light fixed? You need some quick service? They'll help you find the right part or point you to the nearest local repair shop for help. The professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts are your one-stop shop for all things auto do-it-yourself, and you can find what you need in-store or online. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today or visit us at O'ReillyAuto.com/MeatEater. That's O'ReillyAuto.com/MeatEater.
A lot of the stuff you just talked about is kind of all influenced by hunting pressure, right? Like whether or not you're going to call in a spot like Michigan or rattle in a spot like Michigan, it's because of hunting pressure impacts.
Yeah.
So here's something that I've wondered about. You tell me if you think differently than this, but I think that today there are more very well educated bow hunters in the woods than ever before, right? You've got all your great books out there. There's podcasts, there's websites, there's magazines. There's a lot of people that not even just the TV stuff, right? There's TV stuff for a long time, but now there's a lot of information out there about how to kill bucks in real world scenarios, not like TV. So there's a lot of guys that understand hunting pressure. There's a lot of people that know how to get into places where bucks will move in daylight, even in heavily pressured states. So given the fact that there's more hunters hunting this kind of way that are relatively savvy, is there anything you're doing differently now than you did 10 years ago, let's say? Given the fact that there's more guys and girls out there hunting the Eberhardt way?
No, I'm still kind of hunting the same way. But the last 2 years, I haven't killed anything in Michigan. I haven't even seen a bull buck in Michigan. So, but you know what? Even back in the 2000s and then in the 90s, you know, there was always a year or two here and there that I didn't kill something. So, but I'm still hunting in the exact same way. There are certain things I don't do now that I used to do. In my first book, I had a whole chapter on staging areas, and I've kind of totally given that up. You know, staging areas work great if you're hunting staging areas out west where a big buck will actually get up during daylight hours and move out to some peripheral area where, you know, he could potentially intercept does going out into a feeding location. But I've just found in Michigan that a mature buck's not going to get up and make that daytime movement because it's just too vulnerable to go and stage where does may go by in the evening, or stage in the morning where does may come by after daylight. And then if nothing came by of interest, he has to physically get up and move to a bedding area and be vulnerable making that movement.
Yeah.
So I don't hunt staging areas in Michigan anymore. They just haven't worked out for me on mature bucks.
Interesting. Now, you just mentioned that the last 2 years you haven't seen a single Pope and Young buck. And I know that you're after that kind of caliber buck. And I'm very interested to hear how you handle that scenario itself. Like, what happens when hunt after hunt after hunt across all these different places you're going to, you're not seeing a single target buck? What did you do in that scenario? Do you end up going to new property after new property after new property just trying to figure something out? Or do you hunker down in your best spot during the rut because you know eventually one has to come through? Do you not sleep for 2 weeks at a time because you're so stressed about it? I'm just wondering, like, how do you tactically and mentally handle that?
Funny. That's so funny. No, I don't get stressed about it anymore. I'm too old for that. But I used to. I was like, God, I'm not killing anything. I got to get out there more frequently. And I used to actually start arguments with my wife to give me a reason to go out hunting. I said, well, screw it, I'm not go out hunting. I'm serious. I did. I used to do that.
Oh, wow.
I don't stress about that anymore. If things don't work out, they don't work out. And yeah, you know, I feel like I'm a figure in the hunting industry, and it's kind of embarrassing not to kill something, but I'm also a realist. And most people know I won't hunt leases. I won't hunt managed properties. I just will not do that because I preach about hunting free permission properties and public land. So there's going to be seasons when you shouldn't be successful. You can't, if you're on that type of property, You can't be successful every year. You just can't do it. It's impossible if you're in a pressured state like we are.
Yeah. Speaking of public, then, let's run one more public scenario by you. And this is one that I know you've talked a little bit about in the past, and some of the things you mentioned already are probably applicable, but I just want to hear exactly what you do. Let's say, for whatever reason, you have to go to a piece of public land for your rut hunt. Let's say it's out-of-state rut hunt, and you haven't been able to ever be on this property before. You've got 5 days. What do you do on that first day? Is that a full-day scout? Is that a little bit of scout during midday instead of staying to hunt that night? What's day one of your 5 days brand-new public piece during the rut?
Scouting, hands down. Blow off first day to scout. I want to have at least 2, 3, or 4 locations ready. And then I don't feel like I'm hunting backwards. Even if it's a 5-day hunt, I got 4 days to actually do hunting where I've got preset locations. you know, locations that are ready to go, I should say. They may not all have the stuff in them, but I know where they are and I can go to them. I have never, ever in my life, when I go out of state, I've never went and pre-scouted them, ever. They are all locations where I go and I scout them and then I hunt. So I don't go pre-scout anything. Now, obviously, you know, when I'm going to Kansas, I got drawn for Kansas this year. I'm hunting places that I've hunted before, so I don't really have to scout them. I just have to go, you know, prep those locations again. But if I'm going to a brand new piece of property, public or whatever, out of state, yeah, I do not do any pre-scouting on a trip prior to when I'm going hunting.
Okay.
And it's been kind of interesting because it's worked well for me. You know, and I went to Ohio one time and shot about 150-inch 10-point, and it was kind of interesting because that was going to be a 5-day hunt. And when I scouted it the first day, the property was just laid out where there was no way I could hunt this property in the morning without spooking deer, because to go on the property, I had to go through areas where deer would potentially be feeding. So I only had 5 days to hunt. I blew off the first day, prepped two locations, and now I got 4 days left and I'm blowing off morning. So I got 4 sits and they're all evening. And thank God I shot this 150-inch 10 point on the second evening of those 4 days I had left to hunt. Jeez. But I blew off mornings. All I would do on morning entries would be spooking deer.
Was there any way to use those mornings in a positive way? Like, did you glass or any, were you able to get anything out of your mornings, or is it literally because of the setup, you just got to stay out and put all your cards into the evening because of what you just described?
I felt very good when I scouted that I spooked deer, you know, I spooked bedded deer that day, but I felt really, really good about the two locations that I prepped. I didn't go out and glass the next morning or anything.
Okay.
Because I'm not going to hunt mornings, so that morning movement wouldn't really mean anything to me anyway.
Gotcha.
And then there was another time in Ohio, which I didn't kill anything. And this was on a 60-acre parcel. And I went down there in mid-December. The other one was in December, and there was snow on the ground when I shot that 150-incher. That was after their gun season ended. The other one was also after gun season, and I went in and I made a big mistake because I usually look at the weather when I go out of state, especially if I'm going in December, and I usually try to go when there's snow on the ground, fresh snow. So I'm looking at sign made within the last 24 hours. And this time I didn't. I went and there was no snow on the ground, but it was getting down into the low 20s at night and the leaves were just super, super crispy. And I prepped a couple locations and the first morning I went in, I mean, I spooked deer a quarter mile away. I could hear deer running through the woods. And I totally blew off the mornings, but I did something really unique on this hunt. Even though I didn't kill anything, I learned something. And this was just a few years ago. After I blew all those deer out of there, every morning after that, I slept in and I got up about 8 o'clock and I went to my two locations and I actually walked into the tree that I was going to hunt in the evening. And I did this early in the morning because the deer, even on my evening entry, the first evening, I spooked deer bedded within like 200 yards of the tree I was going to hunt because the leaves were so noisy. So I went into both of my locations from then on about 8 o'clock, between 8 and 9 in the morning, and I spooked deer each time and I could hear them, you know, I could see the flags and they ran like 3/8 of a mile away before they went into the bedding area. But then when I actually hunted in the evenings, I didn't have to worry about my entry because I wasn't spooking deer with my evening entry because I had already spooked them out early in the morning. Yet the deer, it was such a long gap between when I spooked them and the evening hunt that they were filtering back out from that distant bedding area. And they were actually going by me you know, in the evening before dark. And the biggest buck I saw was 110 incher, and I didn't shoot it. So I didn't kill anything, but I learned something about, you know, spooking deer with a morning entry really early so that they would still filter back out in the evening, but they were far enough where my evening entry to that location didn't spook deer. Do you kind of understand what I'm saying?
I do. I follow you exactly. Have you ever, is that something you would do again in a future scenario then, if you had that type of deal, even if it's a place
absolutely.
You know well? Yeah.
Yep, absolutely. But to go on an out-of-state hunt again, I would never, ever go out-of-state again without looking at the weather and making sure there was snow on the ground or else it was going to be above 35 degrees.
Yeah. Speaking of your out-of-state stuff, you mentioned how a lot of your out-of-state scouting is trail camera focused now.
Yeah.
Has there been an evolution of your trail camera strategy at all over the last 5-6 years? Because I know early on, you know, some of the things you weren't as into them. Now it seems like, are you maybe a little bit more, and have you changed what you do or how you do it so that it works better for you in that scenario, or is it about the same?
Well, I still don't use motion cameras in Michigan. You know, I may put one out, you know, one or two out 1 year. Last 2 years, I haven't had any trail cameras out, but when I'm out of state, I have found that I can actually put trail cameras out on all the locations, and they're all in pinch points or they're at scrape areas and where I'm when I'm going to Kansas or Iowa. And I have found I can actually visit the cameras and it doesn't affect deer movements. It just doesn't bother those deer out there. You know, I can check the cameras, and if I'm taking my two boys now, John and Joe, and, you know, we'll usually have a dozen locations prepped and they all have cameras. We'll check every damn camera during the middle of the day. Out there, you don't have to hunt all day because it's not necessary. The big bucks move in the mornings and the evenings, just like all the other deer. So it's just a lot easier. So we check the cameras and we hunt 100% according to what's on the cameras. And it seems like checking the cameras doesn't affect the deer traffic at the location. In Michigan, you know, I could see putting out cameras where they fed internet wise back to your phones mm-hmm. or your computer, where you don't have to make a physical visit, an intrusion. But because my properties are so far away from where I live and there's a lot of different public lands, I can't afford to put those out. They'll just get stolen and those suckers are expensive. So I don't do that. But out of state, yeah, I use cameras 100% of the time.
Interesting. All right, John, I know you've got to run here soon. So I'm going to give you just one last question and then I'll let you get out of here. Here's the scenario. Let's say I rule the world. I'm in control of the world. I'm in control of your life, and I'm a real jerk, and I'm going to put you in a tough position here. I'm going to tell you that I'm going to take away your ability to deer hunt for the next 10 years. You lose your hunting rights. You lose your bow. Your shoulder can't pull back a bow, and there's no other options. I'm taking it away. Can't deer hunt for the next 10 years unless you kill a 3.5-year-old buck or older this year in a heavily pressured state like Michigan, but I'm only going to give you 1 day to do it. You get 1 day this year to kill that 3.5-year-old or older. What I want to know is what day of the year are you going to pick for your one hunt this year? That's a lot of high stakes on this hunt. What's the day and what is the tree stand you pick? Describe the spot. What's your, you know, everything matters for this hunt. Describe the spot and the day you're going to choose to put it all out there.
It's going to be November 1st, and it's probably going to be in the interior of a 5-acre bedding area, or possibly an all-day sit in a good location with heavy security transition cover between two bedding areas on November 1st, where a buck's going to scent check, you know, bedding area to bedding area, as long as it got security cover for, you know, early estrus does. November 1st is pre-rut. You know, that in Michigan, pre-rut's definitely the best time to hunt, you know, October 28th through, let's say, November 5th, because the mature bucks are still typically on some form of a routine. You know, they're checking their primary scrape areas or looking for those early estrus does. But in Michigan, there's so few mature dominant bucks that during the peak rut, they're typically doed up. So, you know, you just don't get as many opportunities during peak rut. But that November 1st time frame, if I were in a relatively small bedding area, and I was in a decent tree and I had, you know, shooting lanes in five directions, like, you know, spokes on a wheel, that's probably where I'd be, because they're going to be in there searching for those early estrus does. And if they're with a possible early estrus doe, they're going to push them down into the bedding areas to do their breeding. And as you well know, during the those breeding cycles, they'll move around within the bedding area. You know, he'll breed her and she'll bed down. He may stand up next to her for 20 minutes or half hour, and then, you know, he'll go nudge her and she may get up and run 30, 40 yards, and then he'll breed her again. So they move around in the bedding areas, and it's during the daylight hours. So I feel like that would be probably my best opportunity.
And what does that ideal bedding area look like? Because there's a lot of different scenarios. It could be a cattail marsh. It could be like a red osier dogwood thicket. It could be, you know, young cedars. Like, if you had to paint that perfect bedding area for this scenario, what would that look like?
My perfect bedding area would be a grove of spruce trees with some scattered mature timber in it. Spruce trees are awesome for bedding because spruce trees grow to the ground. They always stay tight to the ground. You get white pines, red pines, cedar trees, you know, they have openings underneath them. As they mature, the branches below them die. So spruce trees with scattered timber in it, because spruce trees, because, you know, they have a form at the bottom, there's always going to be gaps between the trees. So if you find an area, you know, a little opening in a grove of spruce with some open timber or something like that, typically there's going to be converging runways in some form of an opening because it's path of least resistance. And that would be my perfect scenario. And also in an area like that where I know deer are bedding in it, it'd also be a great place to do a little sparring sequence here and there. A couple, it'd be an all-day sit. And it'd be, you know, a couple, two or three times during the day, I'd do a sparring sequence or possibly even some cold doe bleat calls.
Well, I like the sound of it, John. I'm betting that you'll get your hunting rights the next 10 years because that sounds like a good scenario. So I think you'll be, with your skill set and experience in that location on November 1st, I believe in you.
I don't know. I've stuck the last 2 years.
this will be your year, John. I really appreciate you taking the time to do this. I know you got some cool stuff coming out on YouTube. You're doing a whole bunch of neat things. Where can people go these days to find your latest work?
Well, we just started a YouTube channel. It's called Eberhardt's Outdoors. So that's kind of what I'm most excited about. And other than that, my website is www.deer-john.com. But the YouTube thing is what I'm probably most excited about right now, Eberhardt's Outdoors.
Awesome.
There's going to be a lot of good information coming out on that in the next few months.
I'm looking forward to that. The videos I've seen so far have been great. So I'll definitely be keeping tabs on it. And John, thank you so much. I hope I can convince you to keep on doing these at least yearly like we've been doing, because I always learn something.
Oh, I love it. I love it. Thanks, Mark, for the opportunity. I really appreciate it. And good luck, everybody out there.
Yes. Thank you, John. Hey, one more thing that John forgot to mention, but later did tell me that he said I could share with you, is that there is an Eberhardt's signature saddle coming out in August, sold through Tethered. Tethered saddles are what I run. I love them. They've got a special design now, specifically with Eberhardt's input. It's a two-panel seat system. You're going to have to stay tuned to hear more soon. Definitely be checking out what Tether's got coming out. I'm sure they will give some announcements soon, but looks pretty awesome. Check out Eberhardt's signature saddle. And with that said, hopefully you feel the same way as I do, which is that was a pretty fun way to talk to a great deer hunter. I think I'm going to keep doing this. I think we're going to bring on some other guys that we've talked to in the past that we thought we know well, but I'm going to put them in some tough situations. I'll pick maybe some of the same questions, maybe a bunch of new questions like this, and see what they would do. What would, I don't know, what would Dan Infault do? What would Mark Drury do? What would What would Dan Johnson do? Now, there's a question. So stay tuned for those episodes in the future, hopefully. I hope your hunting season preparations are coming along well, and I think we should shut it down now. So thank you so much for listening. Thanks for being a part of this community. And until next time, stay wired to hunt.
I'm sure a lot of you guys remember the old ceremonial hunting tradition of eating the heart out of the first animal you kill. Meat from those organs are among the most nutrient-rich foods on the planet. You can get those same benefits your ancestors craved via convenient daily capsules from Heart and Soil. Find out more at heartandsoil.co. And remember, use code MEATEATER for 10% off your purchase.
Outdoor adventure won't wait for engine problems. Things like hard starts, rough performance, and lost fuel economy are often caused by fuel gum and varnish buildup. Seafoam can help your engine run better and last longer. You simply pour a can into your gas tank. Hunters and anglers rely on Seafoam to keep their engines running the way it should the entire season. So pick up a can of Seafoam today at your local auto parts store, or visit SeafoamWorks.com to learn more.